honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting this time with 99-year-old Bill Kendall of Henderson, Nevada, originally from Boston, Massachusetts. We've heard about his landing at Sicily in 1943 with the 2nd Naval Beach Battalion, and when we left off, he described Normandy's Utah Beach on June 6, 1944 as, quote, calm. And I heard you say that, Bill, but I've also read your commanding officer's report on that beach on that day. He said there was a certain amount of aimed, manual and automatic small arms fire on the beaches at the time of the landing, and the beach defenses, which included guns up to 88 millimeters, were also active. And he also said the beaches were under fire from enemy batteries located north and south of them for many days after the landing. So he's talking about artillery, machine guns, plenty of stuff flying through the air.
They were shooting at us already, but we didn't have any physical contact to go after them. They were from more of a distance away, but they were on the end of the beaches shooting across.
So what did you do once you got there?
Well, I got together with my buddy. We just kind of hunkered down. We dug a slit trench and prepared ourselves for what was coming on. But things were pretty calm after we got landed. I think they had a few guns shooting and a few shells were being shot to our basic area. But I was probably more than about 1,000 yards away from any of the stuff when I was hitting. So I was actually in a pretty safe location. I was one of the fortunate ones that I really didn't get into the real heaviness of it, because we just hit the right spot. We actually landed, I think, 1,000 yards off of our regular beach. So we had to scramble and get to the right location, and that was part of it.
So there are very few of you guys left who were there that day. What are some of the things that you saw that day on that beach that stick in your memory?
I remember the dive bomb was hitting the shore as we came aboard. And while we were on shore, I think about three planes came down the beach shooting along the, and I don't think anybody was hit, but that's about the crux of it. Most of it happened after on the beach for 10 or 12 hours, because I guess the Germans had to get themselves organized just like we did. So it took time.
And you're part of that effort to get things organized. So you fired up a generator and started radio communication?
All my gear was gone. I landed with nothing.
It sank into the drink or what?
We had to leave it on the ship, on the LCT.
Again, I mean, I know you've told this story before, but you're saying this matter-of-factly, but this is disastrous. Here, the whole point of you going there, you don't have any of the equipment you're supposed to use to communicate.
I kind of remember exactly how I felt. I know I wasn't scared. That's the one thing I could never figure out, why I was never scared. I always figured like that the Army training really did something to me, it's mentally, to make you go ahead without worrying about things that may cause you problems.
So you couldn't do the job that you were assigned, and your job just became to survive?
So, yes, basically. And then after on, I think the second day, they opened up a radio station. So I went in and worked with England, with messages back and forth between us and England. And that happened for about a day and a half. And then we spent most of the time just keeping the beach cleaned up and bringing stuff ashore. Our group was called the Beachmaster, and they controlled the equipment coming in, the ships, where it should go and stuff like that. So we spent a lot of time working with the group. Actually, in the U.S. Navy book about the, I think it's 100 years of the U.S. Navy, it shows us the beach battalion on the beach, and I'm in the background somewhere. As I remember, I was communicating with phone at the time, so I was just, it's all such a blurry memory now. But we had a place for the German prisoners and stuff. We had to take care of these guys when they come, when they were captured. They built a compound for them right by us. So we had to keep work on that basis.
So you were interacting with some of these German prisoners?
Well, I just knew there were German prisoners. I know that one of the guys, the German, wasn't stepping up, so he gave me a little shot with his bayonet. That was one of the army guys was there. They were guarding the prisoners. They moved them fast. They were under here, and they shipped right back to England.
When you were there on Utah Beach on June 6th, did you think we'd still be talking about that 75 years later?
No.
When did you grasp the significance or the magnitude of what had happened on those beaches that day?
Well, we knew it was a big thing. I mean, with thousands of airplanes coming in and all the ships. As you're crossing the channel, we saw the convoys that were maybe 3 or 4 miles away, and they're on both sides of us. So you know it was humongous. The thing that really got me was the amount of aircraft that would keep coming and coming and coming. And a lot of them were the paratroopers were coming in. And the gliders, you can see the gliders. In fact, there's one of the glider pilots stuck by the beach, and we talked to him. And he gave me his knife, which I still have. Yeah. But he had quite a story.
He shared it with you there? Told you a story on the beach? Yeah. What was the story?
Well, he told us how when he landed, they actually crash-landed. Because once he got out, his job was to head back to the beach area and transfer back to England again.
Yeah, they were on a one-way mission.
Yeah, they were on a one-way shot.
Well, and that brings up a question, I guess. And I've talked to some of those glider pilots, and they knew what they were getting into.
Yeah.
They had a lot of courage. Yeah. I bet you witnessed, you either saw with your eyes or heard about, quite a few examples of courage during that operation.
Oh, undoubtedly. You don't think about the guys being brave or not. You're just doing your job at the time.
Did it weigh on you when you found out how many Americans had given their lives that day?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the tough part.
Have you been back there?
No. I went back to Sicily, but I never got to Normandy. I wanted to go, but I just kept putting it off. I went back to Sicily with one of my buddies that we both had a reason to go there. And that was a good trip. We went to the beach area where we landed, and then we kind of lived for about 2 weeks on Sicily, and we met some wonderful people. You'd be surprised how people treat you when you're a foreigner. That's probably the best part about Sicily, the trip back. But I never really had the idea to go back to France. I thought about it, but I just never could get myself going.
Well, the reason I brought it up is because there are so many Americans buried there.
I saw a program just the other day where they were covering all the graves in Normandy in France.
Well, I brought that up. I'm just wondering how you think those guys should be remembered, all those Americans who are buried over there in France, who were honored at our World War II Memorial in Washington with all those gold stars. How should we remember those individuals today?
You know, a lot of those guys were friends of mine. So, like I said, we all did a job, and those who survived were lucky. I know we left a lot of friends behind, but that's the way a war goes.
There were some that you knew pretty well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know. There's one guy that I remember, he wasn't killed, but he apparently opened his mouth at the wrong time or the right time, and a bullet went through his, didn't even touch his teeth, it went right down his side. So he's one of the lucky ones.
Well, and you've said a couple of times, you were lucky to survive yourself, Lucky Billy. Is there something you look back on and you say, you know, that was pretty close. That was my closest caller. That could have been me.
Oh, yeah. Well, Sicilian landing was a toughie. I really thought we were going to, because when the searchlights hit us, I said to myself, sayonara. When they turned that light off, it was like, wow, we're going to make it.
Well, and speaking of sayonara, Europe wasn't your only theater. Here you've been in North Africa and Sicily. You make the D-Day landings. How'd you end up in the Pacific? What did you do over there?
I went to New Guinea with MacArthur's quarters, and I went to the radio station there. And I worked that for a couple of months, and we worked our way out to the Philippines. We landed in Leyte, and that was our basic base. And from there, we went to Manila, and the rest of the war was spent in Manila at the radio station. They made me a supervisor in the radio station. One of my best things that happened to me, I think, one of the commanders came to me and said, we want you to go with us on an inspection tour in Subic Bay, which is where all the big ships finally landed. What aboard a battleship. My job was to go to the radio station and check out and see how, you know, to do an inspection, which I did. After we were on the battleship, we went to smaller ships. And I finally went to one little guy that had a small crew, and he was telling me, you know, you see those battleships? They have all kinds of fresh bread and eggs and all kinds of good stuff, and we have nothing. So I told my commander about it, and the next day those guys were loaded with all kinds of goodies. I always remember the smile I got from those guys.
Well, and you mentioned before that your brother's airborne unit was assigned to the Philippines. Did you ever cross paths with him?
Yes, I did. In the Philippines, I found out he was close by, so we made arrangements, and I visited his camp, and then he visited me in Manila.
What do you talk about in a situation like that? Here you're with your brother on the other side of the world, and both of you have been through some crazy things since the last time you saw each other.
It's just good to be with your brother. He always took care of me. He was older than I. He apparently had parachuted into the Philippines, and he got kind of damaged up on a shoulder or something. So he was kind of just not in the better shape at the time we met. But that was good to be able to see my brother. That was after about a couple of years.
Do you remember hearing that Japan had surrendered, and was that big news?
We all expected there was going to be a new landing in Japan, so when they found out it was going to be, they were talking peace, it was a big thing. So we knew that we'd probably be going home.
Well, what was it like to come home after all of that?
You know, you had to be assigned to do this. Well, I volunteered to, write orders out. I wrote out my own orders, so I got myself awarded a ship. I wound up in just outside San Francisco for discharge. If I hadn't volunteered to be a typist, I probably wound up in a different place. So I took care of myself in that sense.
Can you still remember your family's reaction when you got back home?
Well, we're all hugs and everything. Yeah, that's wonderful when you get a chance to come back and live with your parents.
And you had a long career as a radio and television engineer. Yeah. Which even included some time at the UN. And you mentioned you worked with Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yeah, that was a good training station. I learned everything. You know, it's surprising, you think you know everything, but then you run into the business and you find out there's a lot more to it than just what hits the eyeball.
Well, I don't want to leave out anything that's important to you, but I want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story. I know you're looking forward to number 100 here in September. What else keeps you going? What do you've got a lot to look back on, 99 plus years, but what do you look forward to?
Oh, I guess staying alive. I'm doing pretty well. I still drive. I have the license for another year after September. I feel like I can go a few more years, but I'm not planning on anything.
What would you say you're most proud of?
I guess that I survived. I guess that's I can say I was very lucky. Lucky in the service and lucky in my regular lifetime. Everything I've done has been a step up. I'm a very fortunate fella, and I know that, and I cherish it. This is a great country. I hated it at the time it happened, but I look back at it, it changed my life. You know, I'm a different guy than I would have been if it hadn't happened. That's about all I can think about, is that maybe I'm lucky in more ways than one.
Well, I'm guessing that your children are pretty thankful you survived the war, too.
I think so, because they came along 20 years later. I always say it's time and tide. Everything seems to fall into place on a regular basis anyway, because you know the tide comes in at a regular time and it goes out at a regular time. And time is not going to stop for any of us. You know, it's just going to keep on going.
Time does indeed march on, and come September, it'll bring us to Bill Kendall's 100th birthday. Don't forget to head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of Bill then and now, as well as some other links related to his story. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.